unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I want to talk about Kishigarbha Bodhisattva. The people who are here for the retreat had a Dharma talk on Kishigarbha Bodhisattva yesterday. I talked to Reverend Master Shekhar a little about what she said. So a foundation has been laid towards understanding what a Bodhisattva might be and what Kishigarbha might be. I'd like to talk about it in a more personal kind of way today. I'd like to begin, however, by talking about how we listen to the Dharma and how we speak about the Dharma. What it is that turns talk into a Dharma talk. What it is that turns our ordinary everyday life into something that is training instead of just being the usual drool. Buddhism as a religion, compared with many of the other options that are on the market out there, has a habit, possibly a reprehensible one, of seeming to deal in abstractions. There are an awful lot of big words in Buddhism, and there are an awful lot of what seem to be concepts to deal with that are difficult to deal with. You know, what do you mean by so-and-so is the standard question. And we have so many technical terms. And we have lists of things. There always seems to be five of this and ten of that. And it all seems to be like a collection of problems that need to be solved rather than something that in fact must be deeply personal. It's the inward heart in each individual of us, not the collective, not the group, shall we say. The individual, if you put enough of them together, you get a sangha. It's the individual heart that is capable of taking life and turning it into spirituality, is capable of taking words or even the sound of a chainsaw and turning it into Dharma. So it's up to you and to me. I'm supposed to be doing the speaking. You're in the position temporarily of being the listeners. We can do this together. When we fail in the endeavor of right concentration and right intention, right is a difficult word. I'm not going to even talk about it too much right now. But let's say skillful and useful and well-directed intention and concentration, then we're able to do this. When we allow ourselves to drift into the habitual forms of self-reproach and self-doubt, anxiety of umpteen different kinds, when we in fact begin to set the Dharma and the Buddha over there or even out of the room while we deal with our quote-unquote problems as though they were separate, then we indulge in the great distraction, which converts everything into abstraction. It makes misery where none was before. It makes us feel like we're in touch with nothing, like there's nothing there, and that progress is impossible. We get bogged down, and life goes on. Time goes on. We die. And that's kind of how it goes. There isn't another way. And true concentration and right intention can save us from all of that waste. It's what makes the sound of a chainsaw into a Dharma talk. It's what makes my words, possibly, into a Dharma talk instead of just yet another explanation of something. With that as a prologue, I want to start by telling a story It's a story which is not out of the Buddhist tradition directly. It actually comes from the literature of the 20th century. It's out of stuff like this that we can make the Dharma, just as much as we can find the Dharma in anything of the so-called books that we read, or of the more so-called orthodox teaching that we receive. Everything is capable of being Dharma. It's a matter of how you use it. Now, back in the 20th century, there was a gentleman named Stephen Vincent Bonnet who wrote a bunch of stuff, but is famous for writing one particular short story called The Devil and Daniel Webster. Now, some of you, at least one of us, is familiar with this story, okay? And I know one other, and probably quite a few people know the story. It's been a dozen years since I read it. My recollection of the details is dim. My recollection of its basic intention is crystal clear. I'm probably going to get the details wrong. Doesn't matter. So let's tell the story about Daniel Webster, who was actually an historical figure, lived in the 19th century, was famous as a lawyer and a politician and a speaker. Very eloquent man. One night, according to the story, he was sitting in his house. It was around dusk, and then the dusk darkened into dark, and he had a lamp, and he pulled the shades down. I guess he was reading, and there was a knock at the door. And he went to the door, and there was a sort of a man there. Now, this gentleman was very forbidding in appearance. He seemed to be on fire. He was angry. He carried a burden nobody should carry. There was something there, something dreadful about this man. And he was the devil, the Christian devil. And Daniel Webster was not accustomed to having people like this knock at his door, but he said hello. And his visitor said, "You need to come with me. We have work to do. You come now." Now, Daniel Webster was not accustomed to being talked to this way. Normally, he would have gently closed the door. But this time, he went and got his coat and hat, and he went with this man out into the darkness. Out there in the yard, there was a buckboard waiting with horses. They climbed on. The devil took the reins. They drove out of town. They went through roads that Daniel was accustomed to, and then roads that were a little more unusual. And pretty soon, he wasn't in the United States of America anymore. So they came to a house on a hill where there was a faint light shining. They went to the house. They got out. They went into the house. The devil turned the lights up. There was somebody there. Now, this gentleman who was there, his name was Jabez Stone, for what it's worth, not worth very much. He was somebody who in his life had desired money, and he sold his soul to the devil for money. And now that it was time for him to die, the devil had come to get what belonged to him. It's an old story. Now, medieval Christianity is full of this story. The devil turned to Daniel Webster and said, "This is where you come in. I can't obtain my rightful due from the contract I drew with this man without formal proceedings. We need, in fact, a trial of the variety that you are accustomed to back in the United States of America." And Daniel said, "Okay." The devil said, "I am the prosecutor. You will be the defendant's attorney. The judge is elsewhere. He's unavailable at present. But we'll be needing a jury." And just then, 12 people came into the room and took their seats in the jury seats. And Daniel thought to himself, he'd seen a lot of juries in his time. He thought this was about the worst jury he had ever seen. These people, heaven knows what they were made of. They were grim. They carried the marks not only of their own suffering, but of having spent a long time passing it on to other people. These were people for whom pain was stock in trade. And he recognized some of the faces. people from that he remembered, that he'd been told about since he was a little boy, people from American history, some of them. Blackbeard and Simon Girty are two I remember. And the gentleman who presided as judge at the Salem witch trials. And there were nine others, I don't know who they were. These were the bad guys. The people who had gone almost willingly to hell with the devil. They'd certainly sold their souls. And they were the jury. This was a difficult jury. The prosecutor stood, introduced himself, they all knew him, introduced the jury to the defendant, who was shaking in his shoes just over there, because he knew what he had done and what was coming. And the prosecutor's speech was short, because the evidence was clear. This person had indulged in the usual troubles that afflict humanity, perhaps a little more than most in some ways, had made a mistake. It was an important mistake. And as far as the devil was concerned, that was the end of the matter. He had to go through the formal proceeding of a trial, but that would be, he was sure, over soon. And he would be able to take what belonged to him back to where he lived. But there was Daniel Webster. The prosecutor came to the end of what he had to say. The only witness was the accused, and the accused couldn't say anything but, yes, that's what I did. And the jury listened, hard-faced, eyes glittering, because they were hungry for him too. People in pain, people in chronic pain, who have been swallowed by their pain, they want other people to feel it too. And they wanted him. So it was Daniel's turn. He stood up and he didn't have a clue what he was going to say. There was nothing he could refer to that you could call justice, because that had been clarified. He couldn't weasel out of the evidence because it was obvious. There was virtually nothing that an attorney could say to amount to a defense. But the words came. He just stood up and said something. You know, I did a Dharma talk a week ago where I happened to remark that the tongue is wiser than the mind. Sometimes the tongue can just say things. And it worked for Daniel. He started to talk about things that seemed irrelevant. What it was like to see the sun come up. What it was like to be a little boy on a farm. What it was like when there was dew on the grass and you walked through. Little stuff. You know what I mean? The things that don't merely feel good, but they feel real, like there was something there. Something of substance. The taste of food. What an apple tree looks like when the wind blows through it. He spoke for a while. Maybe he spoke for a long while, I don't know. And most of that time, because he hardly knew where the words were coming from anyway, and he certainly wasn't making a case, he watched the jury. And it was strange, you know. He could see them change. He could see that there was a kind of a hump that you can get over. You can't see the hump, but you know when you've passed something without even knowing that you were going to approach it. And he felt the jury and himself get over a hump of some kind. And he came to the end of what he had to say. And he just stood there. Everybody just stood there. And the 12 people who were the jurors left the room, made their decision, presumably, came straight back. Didn't take them long. And they said nothing. They just looked at the accused and at the prosecutor and at Daniel Webster and then quietly left the room. And the devil left the room. And the only people left were the accused and Daniel Webster. And the accused vanished and went his way. And Daniel went home. And that was the end of it. And nobody ever saw those jurors or the devil again in that area of the world. Daniel never saw him again. Something of enormous importance had happened, and a soul had been saved. The contract broke. It couldn't stand up under the weight of something that's completely weightless. You know, the taste of potatoes, what it feels like to wake up in the morning. This has no currency in a court of law, but it worked. And it wasn't a strategy. Daniel didn't know what he was talking about. He just said something. Kishtigarbha works this way. You know, Ramastajiyu used to say that we're all like a pipe the water runs through. You don't know where the water comes from. It's kind of behind you. And you don't necessarily concern yourself too much with where that water flows to. All that matters is that you are hollow and the water runs through. More than that, you don't really need to know much about. The trick is to be hollow. There's nothing there. Let the water run through. Kishtigarbha is like the water. It ran through Daniel that night. And he was able to say things that he didn't intend to say, that he had no rational reason to say. It worked. For reasons that were beyond him. This is not weird or mysterious. You know, it's not like being possessed or something. It's not, it really isn't, okay? In the truth, there is no room for anything like superstition or irrelevant belief. There's just no space for that stuff. It's all a matter of just simply looking at what's actually there, like the taste of potatoes. And what the wind's like blowing through an apple tree. Stuff that's actually there. What that jury managed to do. They must have done it inside their own hearts. Was to realize that suffering, their own suffering, the universe's suffering, is like a curtain. And you can actually part it. And see something that's actually there instead of this, the phony. The shade, the thing that gets in the way, that seems to get in the way, that is in fact flimsy. Suffering is flimsy. It's stuff you can separate. You can look through it. Briefly, just ever so briefly, those 12 people managed to do that. And they could just let the man go. Wasn't that hard? Kishtigarbha, they say, is the bodhisattva who stands at the gateway to hell, helping beings not go in there. I heard a monk speaking one day who said, you know, it's awfully hard to get into hell. You really got to try. You don't fall in there by accident. There are a lot of other much more lenient options. You got to work at it. Kishtigarbha is for the people who've worked at it. And actually quite a few of us have. In fact, all of us have done some work in this direction. Not necessarily enough to get us all the way to the door. Kishtigarbha defends the defenseless. Look at the list of people he is usually associated with. Animals, children, women in childbirth, travelers. The world's suckers. The people who are vulnerable in a violent society where people with weapons carry the strength. People with the money carry the strength. These are the ones who get ground underfoot. It's not just the outward manifestation of these beings, but these beings inside each and every one of us. The tenderness that gets ground underfoot. Because suffering and cynicism and anger and doubt seem so much better means of self-defense than willingness and naivety and the willingness to accept that the difficulty of life is for our own good, not a thing that we should attempt to destroy. These are hard things to work with because we so badly want a defense mechanism. You know, we want to get rid of the problem, not deal with it. Dealing with the problem is a whole different thing from getting rid of the problem. Dealing with the problem, you go into it. This is what the Buddha asks us to do. It's what Kishtigarbha helps us do. Getting rid of the problem is something you pay a man to do. It's like taking out the garbage, okay? There's always more garbage where that came from. And actually, in a sense, nothing is solved. Nothing is entered into. No depth of humanity is reached by simply trying to get rid of what ails us. If you go into it, you can get somewhere. You cross the hump. The word bodhisattva usually means a being who belongs to wisdom, belongs to the world of wisdom. Okay, a being, sattva, means a person, a being, okay, something that exists. And so consequently, bodhisattvas, you know, like Manjusri and Avalokiteshvara and Kishtigarbha, are usually personified as people with faces, male or female, depending. And I'm sure that's just fine. I'm sure that it's true. And yet, they're not like angels. They're not like intervening gods. They're not like saints. They're not quite like that. Avalokiteshvara, for instance, and also Kishtigarbha, they arise from a source that is vastly beyond what you could call themselves. You know, while we're kind of not in the United States of America anymore, let's just simply say that it's over to my left. It's where I saw it. There's a range of mountains. It has nothing to do with Mount Shasta. There's a kind of a warm light that rises from beyond those mountains. And that's where what we call Avalokiteshvara comes from. Whether human beings who do enough training can ever penetrate to the heart of what Avalokiteshvara or Kishtigarbha is, I'm not too sure, but I'm told that it's possible. But I know you can see the source of them. What we're dealing with, when you deal with stuff like Kishtigarbha, they're not pieces of iconography fabricated for the education of the illiterate, which is what people always used to think medieval church windows were for, and they were wrong in thinking it. They're not pictures in the mind that are designed simply to help us grasp something emotionally when words don't do very well. They're not like that. They actually exist. If this Dharma talk is worth anything at all, it would be the fulfillment of the intention that people begin to treat, to think seriously, to behave with the understanding that what we're dealing with here is real stuff. It's actually there. In Buddhism, there is no such thing as a concept. There is no such thing as an idea. That belongs in the philosophy department, which is down the hall. Okay? It ain't here. What we deal with is stuff that's actually there. Stuff we can see, but it takes training to see it because we are so preoccupied with the filters that we have taught ourselves normally to see, because we treasure normalcy at pretty much the highest premium possible. Anything to be normal. Dogen used to say, you gotta let go of normalcy. You know, what the world says is okay probably isn't. That the impulses to conform, this is stuff you really got to kind of get beyond. Like the hippies said in the 60s, you know, obey little, resist much. It pays off. Okay? It really pays off. Actually, that was Walt Whitman. It's a long life. The fabrications of the so-called normal mind are the trivia that rattle through our minds every time we sit down and look at the wall. We are so preoccupied with something. Hard to say what it is, but there we are. We're deeply preoccupied. If you practice right intention, right concentration, you can dissolve the preoccupation. You can dissolve that nagging fear that inclines you towards preoccupation. And you can begin to penetrate into a place where things actually exist. Taste of potatoes, wind in an apple tree. Okay? Stuff that's really there. And believe me, this is what saves your soul. Thoughts will never do it. It doesn't matter how good feelings are. They're just gone with the wind. They feel good. It's nice, isn't it? That's kind of the end of it. To do good, be careful of it. If you do something good, make sure it's something substantial. Something that's actually there, not an ideologue's daydream of what might be wonderfully right. Because that will always let us down. Okay, so let's talk a bit about hell and the devil, because we need to. We talked a lot about these things, and in Buddhism, what am I going to say? Yes, there really is a devil and there really is a hell. I'd better be careful before I say that. Let's talk about it a bit. In Buddhism, we teach that the most accessible area of reality, anyway, is divided into basically what we call six worlds. Humans, devas and angels in heaven. Difficult to describe people whom we call the Titan Assurers, who are basically powerful beings who feel they've lost something and are willing to use force to get it back. That's the third world. Fourth world is the animals. We're all familiar with the animals, thank God. We can actually see them. Some of the others, most people have doubt that they exist because they can't see them. But anyway, we'll get back to that. Hungry ghosts. Everybody actually knows what a hungry ghost is, because we experience what it's like to have that nagging, lingering sense of, I want, I'm lonely, I must feed, and I can't because it kind of doesn't work, so I get more and more unhappy. That's hungry ghost. And then there's the hills. Now, if we've been steeped in medieval Christianity and a number of the other more trite and silly interpretations of religious teaching, we think of hell as a punishment zone. You do something bad, you'll go to hell. I remember being told that once by the girl who lived across the street, who said if something had to do with the Bible, I forgot what it was, but she says, you'll go to hell. I didn't even know what hell, I didn't even know what the Bible was. I wasn't well raised, at least not when I was really young. It's part of the vocabulary of an enormous number of people. And we tend to think of hell as a punishment zone. In Buddhism, I can tell you from personal experience and from the teaching itself in the books and that we receive from monks and other teachers all the time, hell is actually not a punishment zone at all, but it does exist. It exists as a variety of what? Purification? Even that sounds grim. It's not grim. I visited a hell one time. This was a consequence of an experience of a past life in which a person had done something that was enormously wrong. And he had suffered as a result. And because he was in my karmic stream, I had to suffer it too. It doesn't stop. Consequence goes on forever. And this was long, like 2,000 years ago, that this guy did his thing. So and it's still here, still with me. And for, I don't know how, maybe 15 minutes, I had the enormous privilege and incredible pain of going to one of the hells. I think it was one of the bad ones, what they call one of the Avicii hells. It was certainly the last stop for naughty boys. But it's not a place of punishment or even reproach. You don't go there and find somebody who lists your sins to you. You don't find some demon poking you with a knife. There are no fires, there's no ice. There's no nasty stuff. There's just an unmovable being who looks at you, eyeball to eyeball, quarter of an inch away from your face. And he's not going to back off. He does not let you off the hook at all. I mean, not even a little bit. There is no weakness of mind there. There is no compromise. There is no allowance for what we hyperbolically call humanity. It's purely a matter of this happened, and now it's you and me. And that's the Buddha. It's not the devil, it's the Buddha. And either, I found, I take complete refuge in compassion, or the suffering is unbearable. I don't mean bearable. I don't mean a little bit bad. I don't mean something you could handle for a while. I mean something where a split second is vastly more than anybody can tolerate. It's this way because it arises from within you. It's not imposed from outside. It comes in here. It's like a fountain from within. And this is what makes it completely implacable. So believe me, you do what you're asked right away. The trouble is, it's so hard. You have to put every scrap of concentration and intention, every ounce you've got, into that commitment to compassion. And if you back off for just a second, the pain comes back, full scale. And it wears you out. You get tired. You get really tired. I was there for a while, I think maybe 15 minutes. I was really tired. And then I was let off the hook. The Buddha backed away. Didn't say a word. This was really important because I realized the enormous kindness of the hells, how indispensable they are, how we would let our muck go on forever, our vagueness, our uncertainty, our indulgence in trivia would drift forever if there were not a point of decision somewhere. And there is one. It's the safety net at the bottom of the universe. It's there. You cannot fail in spiritual aspiration because there is a place down there you can't get past, which will save you. And it's difficult beyond belief. But that's okay. You can do it. Everybody can do it. The strength we have is immeasurable. We don't know where it comes from. Just as Daniel Webster never knew where his words came from. But it's there. The practice of training is to keep that pipe open so that what you cannot see the source of has a chance to pass through you and do the work that it must, to function in this world, in the other five worlds, and in the bottom hell. It will work. Now let's talk for a minute about the devil. You know, in Christianity and a bunch of other religions, the devil's the bad guy. He's usually classified as the ultimate villain who gets his comeuppance at the end of the world. In Buddhism, we have a gentleman called Mara. Well, I remember a conversation. It was a conversation Reverend Master Jiyu had with Reverend Master Daizui. There were a number of us there. And they were talking about Mara. And Reverend Master Daizui said that as far as he could see, Mara is kind of, we'll say, the accuser, the one who causes all the trouble within us, the devil of Buddhism, we'll say. He was saying that as far as he could see, Mara was a fabrication of human experience, that it was something that had no existence at all, really. There wasn't a person. It was more like part of a process. As seeing as a kind of a tester, one who could probe you and stimulate you to more effort, more clarity of perception at least. And Reverend Master Jiyu sort of looked at him sideways and she said, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know about that. And she didn't say anything more. So a couple of years ago I met Mara face to face and I'm on Reverend Master Jiyu's side. Okay, he's there. No doubt about it. And as far as I can see, he is the great unsung Bodhisattva. He doesn't have fancy jewels and strange hats and nice robes and all the rest of it like Avalokiteshvara does. He was dressed in plain grey with a hat. Looked like he'd traveled a long way. He came in a skiff across a river. I think it was a river, maybe it was a lake. And as he approached, it was almost like machinery started to move inside me down here somewhere. Not very nice machinery, like falling to pieces, like an engine that was about to throw a rod being driven full speed and falling to bits. Very very difficult to bear. Not impossible. Not like meeting that gentleman in the Abbey Hill. Not that bad. Different. As Mara comes closer, it gets worse. His proximity increases the feeling. As he backs off, it diminishes. Has all to do with how close he is. He comes pretty close, about as far as from me to the front row. Now a little further away, second row. And he just stands there. He has no particular expression on his face, just looks at me. And then, without really saying anything, he asked if he could come in, as though I was standing in a house. And I said, no, you can't come in. So he came in. Apparently, nothing can stop him from coming in. This is important. Nothing can stop him from crossing the threshold of your existence. You can't stop him. He comes in. He just stands there in what feels like a sort of a kitchen. And then he asked for something to eat. And I said, no. And if you take something to eat, understand that you do so with my refusal. And he did not take anything to eat, because apparently he's not free to do that. So we stood looking at each other. And, you know, I'm having a very bad time here, and he's just looking. And somehow or other, we crossed the hump. The same hump as Daniel Webster and his 12 crossed. You don't know it's there until you're just over it. You can't see it coming. But you know, something's passed. Something important has passed. And the suffering that's going on inside me, you know, this breaking down forward, begins to diminish radically. Drops down to a kind of a low drone. Doesn't stop. And I start to smile. And the wonderful thing is, so did he. That's what he came for. That's what Mara exists for. It's his job in life, to help people over the hump. And the way he does it is by presenting you with something that you can bear, but you can't bear for long. And it's right up in your face. There's no long way away. You can't push it away. It's right there. It won't go away. And it's very personal. Now this is you and he, or whoever he is, and whoever you is. It's very personal. It's not abstract. You can't think it out of existence. You can't make excuses and say, well, that's just my mind. The mind does that. I'm sorry, you can't do this. There he is. And you cross the hump. And he smiles. And then slowly he goes away. Somehow or other he went away without turning around, because I could see his face as he went. And then he just dissolved and disappeared. And when he disappeared, the machinery stopped. This is very interesting. But that's pretty much the Buddhist devil. Very kind. Amazingly generous. Because he takes no credit for what he does. Nobody does an annual festival for Mara. Okay? Nobody says, dear Mara, please help me today. Nobody does. Okay? And yeah, there it is. He's probably the one we really can't do without. In Buddhism and in Buddhist practice, there is a very, very, very vast field to enter into. What they call the Buddha land is a really, really big place. All you have to do is let go of your obsessive grip on what you think you've got. Believe me, the devil you don't know is an awful lot better than the devil you do. An awful lot. At the end of these Dharma talks, we usually say the four Bodhisattva vows. You know, however innumerable beings may be allowed to save them all, you know. They sound very, very impossible. Kind of presumptuous in a way. I mean, how can I claim to save all beings? How can I truly harbor the intention of transforming all the troublesome passions? How can I claim the intention of comprehending the Buddha's truth no matter how big it is? Or of entering into Buddhist understanding no matter how vast? And yeah, that's what the four Bodhisattva vows say. They are vows to do this. The important things about this is A, you can do it. This can be done. And it doesn't take a million years. You can do it now. The Buddha land, which is where all of these things are done completely and a little at a time, it's here, it's not somewhere else. When we speak of, you know, not being in the United States of America anymore, that's true, and yet it's very truly not true. It is right here that the Buddha land exists and where all four of those vows can be met. We have the strength to do it. The strength is not ours. The important thing with keeping those four, attempting to keep those four vows, is that you don't get distracted by your perception of your own limitations. We all have severe limitations. We're all cripples. As far as mind and body goes, we are failing beings. Okay. Strong briefly, weak for a long time, and weakening, it's the way it goes. Okay. The will is not nearly as strong as we would like it to be. If you use your will to try and keep the precepts, it's useful for a while, but in the long run, has anybody found a way to keep the precepts by willpower? Anybody managed it? I'd love to meet them. It's not there. But there is a way. Those precepts can be kept absolutely perfectly. All you have to do is accept that when they are broken, nothing is lost. You are not lost. There is a way. There is always a way. And with the breakages, the way doesn't get narrower, it just simply gets wider. It doesn't get easier, it gets wider. Which is not that I'm encouraging you to break the precepts. This is not an experiment in seeing how far we can go without causing damage. It's a matter of simply looking up all the time. Don't look down into your own inabilities and be preoccupied with that. Let go of preoccupation in all its forms. It's just habit. It's just the mind being lazy. If anybody wanted to point to a single cause of all our distress, he wouldn't be far wrong if he said laziness. It's so much work on the whole system, body and mind, everything that we are, it is so much work to lift ourselves up out of the drudgery of preoccupation with our little selves and be willing to have a shot at the Buddha land instead. This is hard work. It's not laziness. It's not evasiveness. You're not dodging your problems. It's a matter of going through them instead of just bashing your head against them. It's a matter of being open to the infinite promise that hell offers, that the human world offers, that the hungry ghosts offer, the animals, heavens, Padmasuras, all of them. They offer great promise. Which is why on most depictions of the six worlds, there's always a Buddha or a Bodhisattva parked there in each of the worlds. Right there. These are ways of teaching and ways of learning. They are not parts of a prison. And so when we take the four Bodhisattva vows and venture into what seems impossible, actually we're just doing the only thing anywhere that is possible, because nothing else works. We used to have pictures on the windows in here. They were depictions of visions that Rev. Master Jiyu had back in 76 and 77. And one of them, right at the beginning, was of a monk climbing up a seemingly unclimbable precipice and just tearing himself to bits in the process. And down below, at the bottom of the precipice, you could see two roads. One went that way and one went that way. And both of them involved alternatives. Like, basically one was self-indulgence of the most trivial varieties, and the other one was the more complicated, more persuasive self-indulgence of things like being a goody-good and educating yourself nicely and becoming civilized and all that stuff. And both of these roads ended in a dead end. Complete stop. There was a rock fall straight across the road. You can't get through to anywhere that way. But if you're willing to climb the cliff, which is the hard one, because it doesn't look like a road at all, it just looks ridiculous. But if you're willing to try the cliff, then there's a way. What else? Let's say the four Bodhisattva vows. However innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. So thank you.